Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you are a subscriber, welcome. You look amazing. Hope you're having an amazing day. See what happens when you subscribe to the Ethics Experts. You get a bonus greeting on every single episode. So hit that subscribe button. I'm here today with Romina Morris. How are you, Romina?
I'm so good. Thank you for having me, Nick.
Yeah, excited to get you on. You are a consultant, a coach, a counselor. You do a lot of really interesting stuff in some really interesting areas. And just tell us a little bit about what it is you do and how you came to be where you're at right now.
Sure. And I'm doing it all in a very interesting time in addition. Yeah. So, you know, this year has really brought to surface the topic of anti-racism and has highlighted all of the inequities in our society. So it's a really prime time to sort of have this kind of conversation. I am a social worker by background. I am a psychotherapist, registered psychotherapist, but I've also always worked in child welfare initially. Like that was my starting point in my career. And, you know, child welfare is a system, you know, child protection is a system that is inherently racist, if you will, has a really poor history for disproportionately separating children from their parents from communities of color. Mm-hmm. And so I had a firsthand glimpse of what that was. And then simultaneously was working in an organization that was white. I was the only racialized person for the most part. And for about 15 years, I was in one place where both things were happening at the same time. I was experiencing the effects of being the only racialized person, watching the system fail people of color, and then also trying to bridge that gap and trying to do that work in a racialized body.
Where what was that like?
It was very difficult. Difficult for two reasons. One, we're talking, you know, 20 years ago, so we weren't having these conversations. We couldn't even say anti-Black racism 20 years ago. It was diversity, it was inclusion, it was very soft, obviously. This is all very recent that we've ramped up our dialogue about this. But additionally, it wasn't asked for. It wasn't sought after, but it lives within me. I am a social justice advocate. That's why I got into social work. And then I obviously am attuned to it because I experience different isms. So it was very tough in that sense because it wasn't asked for and it wasn't part of my role. I just brought it to the organization and needed to be done. So yeah, very challenging. And I think many people can appreciate that doing equity work within an organization, you know, housed and sought after and positioned in an organization, that's just not even cutting it these days, because those positions, even though they're titled nicely that we are looking for equity, diversity, those people are often people from marginalized communities and are not well supported in an organization and often seen as the person for all of that stuff. You know, and so it becomes a very personal thing. So even though for me, it was always, you know, I would walk into places and spaces and rooms and people would say, oh, can't say that, Romina's here, as if I was like the police of, you know, inclusive conversation.
Yeah, totally.
It became about me and became very, very difficult. Hence coming out of that and needing to sort of regroup and think, how can I serve better where people are actually seeking my input and wanting it rather than trying to meet that resistance? And so that's how I fell into, or landed nicely, if you will, into sort of doing this for myself. But bringing all of the things that I bring in terms of being a therapist, when I say therapist, I'm specifically talking to people from a race-based trauma lens, right? So talking to people like myself who are navigating spaces where they're not able to bring their authentic selves to work or to their relationships, or where they're struggling with, you know, both hats, children of immigrant parents who are now adults navigating, you know, Western society. I do a lot of that in terms of identifying people's social locations and then working with them from that lens in a therapeutic relationship. But additionally, because it's a both and, 2020 has brought me this idea of both and. So I'm supporting people who are being harmed by virtue of their bodies emotionally, and then also working with those who are inflicting that harm, often unknowingly, often systemically, but that's our leaders, that's our organizational culture. So I wear both hats, and in that sense, I can do consulting in terms of looking at policies, looking at what's working, what's not, but also coaching. I'm realizing there's such an appetite for that, because this isn't a training, this isn't a, you know, sit through us. It's a whole, like, it's heart, mind. values, it's all that stuff. And that can only happen with some really deep coaching around where did you come up with these thoughts and ideas and values? And then how do we reconcile that with what we actually know to be true for other people's lived experiences? Marry that together.
Because the experience, you know, the organization doing the affliction, so to speak.
Yeah.
The organization, obviously, like legally or from a tax perspective, is an entity, but it's not a like living, breathing thing. It's just made up of a bunch of people. So
people.
To the extent, to your point, to the extent that the organization is afflicting these things, that's really a bunch of individual sort of in mass, you know, the collective, that sort of flawed view or whatever is actually the root of the cause. And given your background, it seems like you're kind of this kind of jack of all trades. You can come in and build a bridge from this side of the chasm or this side of the chasm or from the middle or whatever. And it's a very powerful thing. You know, it's kind of ironic in a way. You know, it kind of struck me when you were talking about how, you know, no one was talking about this for a while. And then people started talking about it. And then they, you know, they create a diversity and inclusion officer and they kind of put it all on them. And it almost at some level, it like drives more division within the organization. Like it's an ironic band-aid on a broken arm or something. You know what I'm saying?
It really is. And I think most people started, and maybe not wrong, but started with the forward-facing piece. So whoever their client is, their customer, their patients, their like, so the effort from leadership was, hey, our customers, our people, our whoever, clients, patients, are being impacted by our biases. Oh, frontline staff need to get that sorted so that when they're engaging with frontline parties, that is unpacked and understood. But what they neglected to understand is that simultaneously, it's the same thing happening. It's a parallel process. So how you are behaving as an organization is role modeling for your frontline staff of how to behave with their your forward facing. So I think the misstep has always been traditionally looking at where is the rub coming from? And it's often coming from the accountability is coming from clients, customers, patients, and switching that to say, oh, it's a both and, right? It's we have to do the work ourselves in order to support and model it. Because what would happen is, we would have frontline workers trying their best to, okay, I got to figure all this out. Right. But who's checking that for them? The leaders, who's checking that for them? The next layer of leadership and on and on. And so how do you have that conversation when nobody's having the conversation and expecting people to have very difficult internal reflections on their work? It doesn't work that way. It has to be simultaneous.
It has to be simultaneous. And
it has to be.
And trying to put that cart before the horse. I mean, you know, you kind of talk about like the authenticity and it's almost like an inauthentic way to solve the problem caused by inauthenticity.
Here you go, right? No, really, it really is. And it doesn't add up. And people feel that, people know that, people recognize that, people look at leadership and go, but your practices and you just hired your best friend and, you know, you let go of somebody that doesn't look like you. And like, what, like, how does this doesn't fit. And so people know that it maybe can't put their teeth into it, but it doesn't feel right because it's not being mirrored in the organization. So I do feel a lot of companies are going, oh, it's us too. Yes, it's you too. So that's more the appetite today is okay. So in-house, what do we need to do to course correct? Because our leadership, our board does not reflect our community, our patients, our customers. That's what I'm seeing a lot of is, okay, help us get back on track so that we're all moving at the same time.
Yeah, if you're overweight or, you know, you're unhealthy, you're overweight, you don't fix that by just wearing like leggings and athletic wear. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like you have to get healthy. You have to actually change your body,
action,
your weight, your activities, your habits, all those.
All of it. Action and understanding how you got there and understanding why it's unhealthy and understanding the harm that it's doing to you. And yes, exactly. That goes wherever, whatever change you're looking for, whatever behavioral changes we need. We know psychology tells us, right? It's thoughts, feelings, and actions. So your thoughts are going to determine how you feel. And those feelings are going to determine how you act. So if you think this person would be a great fit in my organization, you're going to feel good about hiring somebody that feels like a fit, typically someone that looks like you. And then you're going to act towards hiring and retaining people that look like you. It just flows. It's just how our bodies, brains function. So we have to apply that in real life. I think we've disconnected human behavior from organizational behavior.
Yeah. And I guess if there's nothing deeper than just the way someone looks as the determinant as to whether or not they're a fit, everything's going to stop there, right? But if we can sort of transcend the physicality of it to something that's more resonant, right? Something that's bigger than us, something that's purpose-based or values-based, well, then we can relate on values irrespective of where our parents were born. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. But how do we get through that block? You know, the one that says, no, this is familiar, that affinity bias, right? That this feels familiar, this feels good, this is comfortable. Affinity bias is when you have a bias towards people that you, that are similar to you, that look like you, that are familiar to you. There's an affinity to that person because of whatever, faith or, you know, age or gender, whatever feels good. We tend to want more of what we already know, which is ourselves. That's not a bad thing. When we talk about unconscious bias, or when I talk about bias, I often explain, like, people, this is not a bad thing. Bias has served our purpose. It's a thing that actually, it's for survival. It protects us, right? So when you think about, you know, it's tribes and,
you know,
it really is, right? I mean, little children do it. When they see a dog and they see a horse, they say dog because it's four legs and it's familiar and it looks. Our brains do that. That's not the problem. What's happened, though, is that was a great setup when we were living in times where we all lived in these tribes or in these villages or in these communities that were needing to keep safe. So not having intruders come in and take over our village. But today we're like 100 different villages, thousands of different villages all living together. And there it becomes a problem, because now that is actually creating harm for people that don't look like you, because you are obviously creating opportunities for some, not for others. Things get a little wonky. So it's not a bad thing to have bias, but boy, you have to check, what's at play here, right? What's happening here? And how can I stretch myself so that that's not always the first go-to, because we miss
not my default like criteria. Or my default criterion is not just like how close they look like me. And, you know, there's not, you know, if you're just leaning into that affinity bias and you're just hiring people who look like you, pretty soon you're going to have a house of mirrors that you're working in. And there's not a lot of diversity of thought in a house of mirrors. You know what I'm saying? It's just a bunch of reflections of yourself.
Yeah. And that's really boring. Like, that means there's less creativity, there's less innovation, there's less worldviews, there's less, like, when you think about people that you know, or you've interacted with, even when people go on vacation, maybe that's their only exposure to like a, you know, a broader, deeper culture other than North American. But those interactions are so inspiring. Why? Because we go, people do that, or people don't do that. Or, you know, and we talk about things when we go to other parts of the world where the concept of time and this rush, rush, rush is not there. Things are slow paced. Problems are there. People are poor. People are suffering. But this heavy anxiety isn't there. Why? It's a different vibe. It's a different culture. So we go, this is different. But if you don't see that, you wouldn't know that. And I encourage people to go, but look, you know, you have that really cool exchange with a taxi driver when you're traveling, or an Uber driver, and you're like, wow, that person's had a whole different life, come from a war-torn country, couldn't imagine. And we do that once in a while and we go, that was interesting.
That was novel.
That was novel. But what if you could do that every day? Because you can hire that person, and you can hire people that look like him, her, and others. And bring all of those lenses to, like, can you imagine? That to me is like, there's so much in that, because we cannot know more than what we know. So you got to bring in people that do know something different. That's
right.
That's so exciting. That's what's to look forward to about bringing brains together. So this whole, like, everyone looking like you and being familiar is so stale and so boring and so unnecessary at this point.
So this hill that you're climbing, you know, equity and inclusion hill, or this anti-racism hill, the slope of it is changing a bit, right? Because it used to be sort of like a sheer rock face. Now it's changing a bit. But what do you think the nature of the slope is now? And what do you think, like, how would you describe or kind of characterize the resistance to this message? Like, what's the nature of the resistance? What's at the root of it? Is it ignorance? Is it lack of understanding? Is it true kind of hate? You know what I'm saying? Like, what is and why can't we just send this little podcast around to all the CEOs in the country and them just be like, do this, right? Like, there's some resistance for people to not turn the light on and just jump with both feet into the pool. What is it?
Mm-hmm. And I would say it's probably a little bit of all of that, but the most common theme that I come across in terms of speaking with the dominant group is the discomfort of having the conversation. sends some vibrations through the body that just go, I can't hear this. Right. You know, people talk, people talk about the white shame, the white guilt, the white fragility. I think it's probably because it's something that has never been put to people's face, in their face at this moment in this way. So for people who are racialized or who are marginalized in other ways as well, we've always walked knowing we are different, we have to navigate certain, like this whole experience is all we know. We know also that others don't have to do this, right? We know that the majority of people don't, that that's our difference, and that just sucks.
How do you know that?
Well, because you see it all the time when people talk about, you know, their problems. In communities of color, we'll say things like, you know, that's white people's problems, right? Like, oh, you can't decide between whether to vacation here or there. I'm trying to put food on my table because I can't even get that promotion that I'm due. Like, it's such a different conversation. And in our racialized communities, there are conversations that happen and experiences that are shared, not to the level that we are now. Now we are talking way more openly about how it is hurting and impacting and adding way more stress than we ever realize, right? We just know that this is how it is. This is who you are in society. There's a hierarchy and this is where you fit. And we know that the white male, cisgendered, able-bodied man is the top. And we all kind of fit categorically somewhere different, depending, and intersectionalities at play. But for us, it's always been a known thing because we're navigating these spaces on a regular. These are the conversations our parents have, right? So a lot of people will talk about, oh, I've had to have the talk with my child about my racialized Black child, for example, talking about when you encounter police, you know, but it's more than that. It's more than that. It's also how do you navigate school and talk to the principal, right? Because before you get to the police, there's a principal you got to get through. Before that, there's also conversations that I'm having with my 15-year-old mixed race son, who is, my children are half Black and half South Asian. Does your white girlfriend's parents know what you look like? Because they may have a problem with that, my son. We have to talk about safety in terms of just emotional safety. These are the kinds of conversations we have that we know others are not needing to have because there's no conversation to be had. So right. the resistance.
Just that fact is proof, is your point.
Just that fact is proof. Yeah, yeah. That fact that people go, oh, you have to have that. Yes, we do. But we didn't know that we could have this conversation, right? We didn't know that, but now this opportunity is there. So the resistance that's coming, I think, it's always been the same thing of, no, I don't want to hear this. I don't want to see this. This can't be, because it means I have to reconcile my ancestry. As racialized people have always had to do, I think white people are also understanding ancestry is yours as well.
Reconcile ancestry?
Where are you really from? Who are your people? How did you get here? What was the root? How did colonization play a part in that? Because the world has been dominated by colonization, like the world over. Like it's just
throughout history. Yeah, yeah.
There's no place untouched. I think there's one country in Africa that was never colonized. Other than really? That, like that's just one continent with like 50 something countries. Yeah. It's insane. But there's a story within every one of those countries. And the point is that it's almost like for the dominant group, for white people, there's an opportunity now that is really scary. And that is to take a peek and look at the big picture and see what has happened greater than your town, your village, your community, greater than your city, greater than even your country or North America, but the world over, because this anti-Blackness, this is not an American thing. Sure, no. It's a big American thing. The whole country was founded on anti-Blackness, but that is resonant in my homeland of East Africa, of India, like my ancestors are from India. Anti-Blackness is live and kicking in India. Don't get it wrong. Our community is very, very racist towards Black people historically. Yeah. So it's not, this is not a white problem. This is an anti-Black problem. We just dance in both spaces, right? Some communities can dance in both spaces, be racialized and also be racist, if you will, in terms of having a lot of privilege and power over Black people.
Tell me about that distinction. I didn't follow that.
Well, for myself, for example, I define myself as a racist, anti-racist. Okay, because I cannot just be an anti-racist without acknowledging my racist behavior. Now, that doesn't mean that I go around and like I'm just a hardcore racist, you know, white supremacy. No, obviously. But what it means is that as someone who is not Black or not Indigenous, in Canada, we speak a lot about our Indigenous peoples. America hasn't quite got there yet. But these two things, anti-Black racism and anti-Indigenous racism, are things that my community, I identify as South Asian, have participated in. But I also have experienced racism directly. Like, you need to leave this workplace because we cannot handle this anymore. So I've been squeezed out, let go for speaking up about microaggressions in the workplace. Okay. Often on behalf of my Black colleagues, not even for myself. But I experienced that because of the body I'm in. But I can equally, as a child protection worker, I can equally walk into a home and take an Indigenous child from an Indigenous mother and say, this is what's best because that's what the system's told me to do. I'm acting as a racist and part of a big systemic racist problem. If I work in a hospital setting and I am doing things that are not in keeping with someone's honor, their tradition, their culture, I'm partaking in that, not intentionally, not as a bad person, but as a big picture system. So I think
you can be racist without intent. There doesn't need to be intent behind racism. Is that kind of the point?
Correct. Because the intent actually matters not. It's always the impact. And that was one of my first learnings when I got into this work is, but wait, like if it's just, someone says it's just a joke, I was just joking, doesn't that count for something?
Well, that's right? So like joking, but is it? Well, in my mind, I would say somebody making a joke, the joke itself, the comedy and the joke is the uncomfortability that comes from stepping over some kind of a line. And so I'm just saying while they might not mean the racist thing, making that joke is, I think, different. And again, I'm uneducated.
No, tell me.
Like, making that joke is different than somebody like innocently saying something that somebody else perceives as racist. Like I've seen someone say, oh, I love your hair. You know, a white woman saying to a Black woman and the Black woman taking offense to it. Yeah. And so this particular situation, I can't sort of speak for anyone's heart. I'm just saying it didn't seem like there was any ill intent in there. She was trying to give this other woman a compliment. The other woman took it wrong. So I'm just saying those two seem like different things. Me making an off-color joke is different than me just saying
someone
that it's unintentionally taken as racism, I think, but I could be wrong.
But except that what we're learning is that whether you meant it as a diss, as a slight, as a real mean comment because you're very conscious of it, or whether you did it as, oh, I didn't realize that was going to offend you, the feeling that the person receiving it has is the same. And that's what we need to focus on. I don't really care about your intent. What you need to hear is that in saying that, whether you meant to or not, this was the impact. So now think differently. And let's unpack that, because when the comment about the hair is intended as curiosity or a compliment and is received as negative, think about that bigger, right? What's that Black person's experience with hair? Period, right? From birth, messages. Yeah. But messages from family saying, oh, your hair is nappy, or your hair is this, or negative comments, right? And then going on and on through life, knowing that if I go to work with my afro or my dreadlocks, that is unprofessional. So I have to straighten it, or I have to tone it down, or I have this European idea of what beauty is, and it looks like my hair. So hair is a great conversation. My girls are mixed. They have beautiful hair, mm-hmm. and they hate it. They hate it because they see me.
Because the beauty standard here is different. So yeah, absolutely.
So now when that woman says, hey, I take offense to what you just said, it's different than what we initially thought. It's not just an angry woman who just doesn't, it's like a lifetime of experience telling me that my hair is bad. And that's the miss, right? So now when we think that through, the intent, okay, great, is a learning opportunity, but be mindful because the impact on people who have lived with messaging from in their homes, in their families, in their communities, in their workplaces, your hair is bad. Your hair is not okay. Right. And so it's that context that gets missed. And that's white people's privilege to not know. That is white people's privilege to not know that hair is a thing. To not know that subtly they are giving, always have, messages that Black hair is not nice, it's not pretty, it's not attractive. That's the privilege. And that's why it's feeling uncomfortable, because like, wait, what do you mean? It's all new information and it's a lot and it's coming fast and furious, mm-hmm. but it's not new for too many people. So it's almost like we can't sit back and wait for you to catch up, right? Like this is the system we're in. This is the situation we're in, but we can't wait for 400 years of you to figure out what you did wrong, where we've gone wrong as a society. It's course correct, like now. Yeah. So put aside your intent. And just listen to the impact. It matters, right? That's the bigger picture. And that happens in workplaces, those subtle messages all the time. That's what I hear. I don't experience this directly. You understand? Nobody said that to me about my hair. They made a comment on the gray and what's well, that I'll about?
Tell you, I think your hair looks nice. I hope you don't take it off.
I love it. I love the gray. I'm owning the gray. I'm owning it.
You got to own it. Guess what? You earned that.
I've earned every one of them, but to be truthful, it for me, it is about the same idea of showing up authentically and naturally. And what is my natural hair state? It's gray. Bring it on. If it was curly, it would be that. But it's always sort of just being mindful that how can I show up authentically in spaces that I can. But it's different for other communities. It's not the same at all.
So I want to go back to this anti-racism thing and draw the distinction between these three terms, and maybe you can just kind of speak into these. So racism, not racist, anti-racist. How do those three things interact with each other? Are those on different are a couple of those on different ends of a spectrum? Is one not like the others? Like, how do we think about the term anti-racism versus someone saying, I'm not racist? Is that even a valid?
No, I think for far too long, the majority of white folks have said, I'm not racist. That's not me. Right. And that has been the problem, because in being not racist, you're being racist. And so,
tell me about that.
Yeah, because you're not doing anything. We talk about action. We just talked about like your thoughts, feelings, behaviors. The behavior is the action. So if you think everything is okay and there's no racism here, then you feel very comfortable with the way the world looks and feels for you in your white body, then your actions, your behaviors are like status quo, please. Nothing to see here. Rewind. If you see the world and you think, man, there's disproportionalities. All these Black people in jail, are they really that bad? You know, what's going on? Black people getting shot all the time. This is disproportionate. This doesn't add up. Numbers don't even make sense. Something's off. If you think that, then you're going to feel unsettled about your privileges and your undeserving privileges. Let's be clear. You're going to feel discomfort in that. And then you're going to want to do something different. And that's the behavior. And in order to do something different, you have to action. That's an anti-racist, is actioning, doing something towards getting rid of racism, dismantling it. It doesn't have to be this, you don't have to be a CEO of a big corporation to do anti-racist work or be an anti-racist leader. You could be anything. People talk to me about, like, I often say, if I was washing floors, I'm still an anti-racist. Is this equitable? Is this fair? Is this safe? Human rights, like, it doesn't matter where I am, because that lives within me. And so anti-racist work is recognizing and thinking, this isn't fair. This is undeserving. Something is off. Feeling disgusted about it and wanting to do something about it. And then you act on it.
Got it.
I'm not a racist is just a really great way to just do nada, to say, I don't see color. I don't see nothing. And of course that is the biggest problem. How can you pick when you see color? That's not fair. You can't say, I don't see color unless I need to rent my apartment to somebody and then I'm picking the white family over the Black one. You can't say, I don't see color unless I'm looking for someone to do my gardening and then I'm going for a Hispanic person. Like, what?
Right.
You can't pick and choose. So it's either you get it and you understand that there's a problem here. And the other big thing, Nick, that I think I'm truly coming to terms with in this moment, because it has been fed to me the same as you, as everybody, that this is like hundreds of years ago problem. This happened, Jen. My ancestors didn't do anything. But I'm not responsible for my ancestors and what they did. This is a big rhetoric of white people. Like, I didn't do anything.
I think it's a big rhetoric of all people. I don't think it's just a white person thing. But
True.
I think people would not take responsibility for their ancestors'
behaviors.
Behaviors.
And yet we ride on their backs. We ride on the backs of our ancestors.
Yeah, we stand on their shoulders. Absolutely.
100%. And so it's a very Western concept to forget where we come from, right? It's a very Western mindset. You're here for the moment. You push your kids out at 18.
All about me. I is the first
individual.
Letter. Yeah. Yeah.
These are not concepts. But think about that, because most of the world, when you go back to their ancestry, so Asia, India, Aboriginal peoples all over North America, South America, their roots and their culture and their traditions are so inherently different from the Western idea that we just talked about.
Well, they're deeper, if nothing else.
Well, they're deeper. They're about community. They're about each other. There is a collective understanding. There is a symbiotic relationship with Mother Earth. You don't take more than you need.
There's a homogenous sort of people group and the basis.
It's just back to basics. It's just totally, back to basics. And we have lost our way. And in that, you know,
in the melting pot that is America.
Well, no, I'm going to say no. I'm going to say in the domination and the belief that white supremacy is absolutely at play all the time. So melting pot, how all of the people that have come through the Atlantic slave trade and were stolen, like literally human trafficked, right? And brought, and now their descendants are here today.
Right.
That wasn't hundreds of years ago. It's a couple of generations ago that we're just getting to the point of, like, 60s is not that long ago, right? The 60s and the civil rights movement was just yesterday.
New. Yeah, it's not old.
But as a child, it seemed like that was so long ago. And when I seen the protest this year, it was chilling, because I'm like, I used to say to my husband, man, I wish I was in the 60s. I grew up and I would have been out there. I would have been. Yeah. Hello. Yeah. The 60s is today, is right now. And nothing's changed. You know, things have symbolically changed. Words have changed. Language has changed. Laws have changed. But actions, behaviors, thoughts, feelings, not so much. Not so much. So there's a need now to sort of own that I am anti-racist and I'm doing something different, as opposed to, this is not me. This doesn't apply to me. I'm not doing anything.
So what this really is a game of influence and a game of persuasion to turn their light bulbs on. I think in the context of this conversation, I think you've spoken into some of the challenges that task like brings to the table. How do we make that persuasion path more effective or more efficient? Or do you know what I'm saying? Like,
I do. And I almost want to ask you, I almost want to say, what do you think? Because, you know, we can't rely on people's humanity. Yeah. We can't rely on people to do the right thing, you know, just based on human rights and just.
I don't know. So, it's an interesting thing. I read this book, How to Be an Anti-Racist this year. I read a bunch of things this year that I wanted to kind of get educated on this.
Yeah.
And this thing, like, everyone are, you know, there's all these new words that I hadn't, like anti-racism. Anti-racism, a word that I even maybe knew of 2 years ago.
There you go. Right.
All these things are flying around. I'm like, all right, well, I want to understand and get educated on it. And in it, I think I learned some things and some light bulbs turned on for sure.
Sure.
But then I'm kind of, you know, here with you and I'm thinking like, okay, well, 10 years from now, if nobody needs Rumina, right? Not like in the sense of life.
I'm saying, I know what you mean. Yeah.
And to fix a workplace, that means that this thing that you're, you know, a pioneer of or a champion of took fire. Everyone gets it and it's all fixed, right? So like, in order for that to happen, a bunch of like light bulbs have to go on. How do we do it? And I think as you try to, I mean, you kind of talked about it just now. Like, as you talk about it, you run into like, well, no, somebody doesn't want to take responsibility for their ancestors, or someone doesn't want to, like, there's cognitive dissonance inherent to you saying, no, you're racist. And someone's like, well, I take mass, you know, I don't view myself as a racist. I try to view people on the content of their character. So I'm just saying, in that interaction, there's a ton of cognitive dissonance that needs to be overcome for the person, the adversary, so to speak, in this conversation to recognize, oh, I see what you mean by that term. There's a miscommunication here. I think we're saying the same thing. That has to happen.
Yes.
What I've seen in a lot of the rhetoric around this topic is, you know, again, I paint in really broad brushstrokes, so this might not be the
right word,
but almost like guilting people into it and, you know, kind of hitting them over the head and shaming. And just in my experience, just in life, I don't think that's that, there's not a lot of staying power for getting change with a root in shame or guilt or something like that. Like it's I need to put the fire out now. I need to hire a D&I person and then I not hear about it again.
Yeah.
That's not fixing the issue. This is a foundation you have to fix. So
no.
Getting at. So how do you do it?
Well,
I don't know. But the persuasion path has to be one that is not, I think, beating people up. That's just my own thing.
100%. No, I agree with you. I think there needs to be straight truth talk. And I think what one of the gifts that I have and that I have been given so much feedback on is the ability to get people comfortable with the conversation. Can we just, and you know, like there's a whole thing because, you know, people's defenses go up if they hear, you know, and I've seen that. Like,
yeah,
of course. Yeah. You know, you can say that to me and I can go, grandpa's, oh
my uncle's a racist. I'm not a racist, whatever. Right.
Yeah. And we make it about people and that, but you know what, it's both and because it is people who make up the systems, but it's the system at play when we don't know what we're, when we can't see what we're actually doing, because it's all we know. So I think there's two things to that. One is definitely people need to have their aha moments and have their light bulbs go off, whether they want to or not. There has to be some soul shifting. No question. Without some of that, we're not going anywhere, because the power sits in those hands. And until the power is let go a little bit and shared just somewhat, please, nothing can shift. So there has to be some of that, like, oh, okay, I get it for sure. But we can't sit around and just hope that, as I said, people are not, if they haven't yet on human, like if you haven't hurt watching people dying on the streets on a regular basis yet, it's probably not going to happen. How much worse does it have to get, right? This year has kind of set things in motion to collectively bring people and communities that don't look like white men, cisgendered, able body to say, hey, enough. And the shift is that's happening that will allow for change to happen, whether or not people are internally shifting, is the pressure and the accountability. Because as numbers, as people, we're, you know, marginalized people are the majority. The dominant group is actually, you know, the minority, but very powerful.
40%.
So what's shifting is this whole idea that in order to, you know, if you can't see your blind spots, as I cannot see mine all the time, the only way through that is to bring in different mindsets. So you don't have to do all the work. I don't have to think about every single possible lens. I maybe will miss something if I'm doing something and I don't think about, well, what if somebody has a visual impairment when I'm doing this presentation? I might not think, I can't. There's too many. You know, it's not possible for me to think about
everything. You're blindest at that point.
However, if I bring in or have people in my network and in my pool of people that can bring those different lenses. So I have a privilege of working in a field where all of that difference is my network. That is all I see and surround myself with. And so when somebody says to me, hey, can you bring this lens? Listen, you know, we need an indigenous lens on this. No, not me. But I have somebody, 100%. Or I need to get someone to like, that's modeling that I'm racialized and I'm a female. So that intersectionality is real. I cannot figure all this out. I am absolutely reconciling with my own anti-Black racism within my own home and my relationship with my husband, with my children, with my family, right? I'm doing this with you. That's the point. It's like, so why are we doing this whole, you've got work to do and don't ask me to help you. I know there's a place for that. Yeah. I get it too, because I'm tired of it too. But when people are asking for it and are welcoming it, let's sit down and let's try and figure this out, because it's that ripple effect. You know, as with anything that is, you know, as you said, the persuasion path, it's all influence and it's all ripple effect, right? And each one teach one. So we have to do something. And I don't see anything shifting anytime very quickly. A lot has happened, but I think, you know, I don't see anything major happening in my lifetime. This is all for the future. No.
Really?
Because there's no one person, nobody who doesn't have work to do. Even those who are doing it for a living, right? It never ends. There is no end in sight. We just got a course correct like yesterday. That's all. Yeah. I don't know what it is. When you talk about, like, you know, 10 years and it's all no need for Romina. That's not even in my vision at all. It's just doing something that we can say we recognize that the moment is what it was. 2020 is nothing to run from, my friends. There are lessons to be learned. And if we don't tap into Mother Earth is telling us something, has been for some time with the physical earth. Mother Nature is telling us, y'all need to slow down, pause, reflect. Because health is everything, right? Like if you don't have health, Your quality of life sucks. And for many people, their health, physical and emotional, has been destroyed by this racist system. Okay, so the pandemic, the virus is one piece, but in addition to all the other layers of health issues that people of color have been experiencing, something has to change. So that's the wave is shifting. So 2020 for me is like, look at all those nuggets of wisdom and need for change that are in this year, because it's not going to get better unless we get better collectively, I think.
Right. And I think to accelerate it, you know, you asked earlier, well, how would you do it? And I think to accelerate, I think, look, like, this is a new thing, right? It's out, we're trying to figure it out, and we're trying different ways to address this problem. In that, there's just inherently going to be failures and successes and so forth. I think we can accelerate the light bulbs turning on. I'm trying to work you out of a job, Romina. That's what I'm getting.
I wish.
But we can accelerate those light bulbs turning on if we can help people feel safer in that, like,
there you go.
Bathtub of like this thing that we're trying to fix. Like, you're in it, but you feel safe in it. You're like, you've acknowledged it, you've digested it, you've figured out a way to like reconcile and hold all those things together. And there's not this like violent cognitive dissonance in you. And now you're like, okay, well, I'm in a boat that's got a little bit of water in it. I'm going to start working to bail it out.
There you go.
There's other people who don't, you know, because they're hit over the head with it, or because there's cognitive dissonance attaching a label. There's just a lack of empathy in this conversation, I think, broadly on both sides, to be honest.
That 100%.
Because look, it's new. There's pent up thing. I think there's pent up things. We got to get this out. I've been looking at these injustices. You don't have to teach a kid what fairness is. Like, my 2-year-old knows when something is unfair. We're wired for fairness.
Inherently.
We're
wired for justice.
So I'm just saying, this has been popped up. True. You see all these injustices. There's a lot of energy behind it. Like, we got to fix this. I finally have a voice. I want to fix it. Yeah. The natural sort of base approach to that is to hit people over the head and be like, you screwed up, shut up and listen to my
thing. Shuts people down.
And it shuts people down. And I'm just saying, like, while all those things in the message may be true, it only matters if the recipient digest it, believe 100%. It, and the idea sticks. So there's something that needs to give in this conversation for it to really ramp up on its like effectiveness level.
Oh my gosh, you are nailing it. And you know, that essentially is what I offer to people. So it's exactly it, because I think you're right. I think you're 100% right. It is what gets me in the door and gets me to be able to engage in these conversations.
Right.
Is that ability to like, I'm doing it too. There is no need for shame. There's just a need to reconcile and figure this out. And I have been in places where people have brought these topics up and I'm like, oh, I feel uncomfortable. This doesn't land right. The messenger often is a big piece of this, right? Because the messenger
it might be the, like, it could be the most beautiful dish ever, but if it's served on a piece of crap plate, if it's served on a you know, a log, you're not going to like
it's not the same.
That meal, right? It's got to be that presentation.
There's a bit of, there's definitely, and I think that is where that therapeutic lens comes in for me in because, you know, when you think about some of the really difficult, challenging, gut-wrenching situations one person have been in, and I often say, like, when you have taken a baby out of a mother's arms, right, and have had to look at her and say, now you want the baby back, you got to come through me, right? Like, that kind of power that you can have over somebody and affect somebody's entire, it makes me ill to think about the things that I've had to participate in. But I say that because if you can do that with respect and with dignity as best as you can, and when you can still develop a relationship with a woman whose child you removed, I mean, that is a specific skill set. And I've seen it where it's gone so wrong and where people have gone to town on just needing to fight the system because of one individual interaction. Right? One thing, but such a meaningful thing. So the delivery and the messenger, you're right, is so everything. And it is what I offer in that I'm saying it's yucky work. It's disgusting. It hurts. It's uncomfortable, but, and let's go. There's no, that shouldn't stop us. And I can help you to get through that. Right. That's the trick, because there is that emotional piece to it. The empathy is a difficult piece for people to have when we feel like we're on such odds. You have inflicted harm for generations. We have experienced harm for generations. Fact. Now what?
The water is, the water's rising in the boat. We got to do something.
Yeah, we got to do something. We really do.
So let's jump to this. Someone who's listening to this is in the ethics or compliance department, or they're in the HR department, and they're vibing with what you're saying. They see these injustices, they want to fix them. They understand that their organization can be a force of good in the world if they could just get some light bulbs turned on at the top.
Yes.
What advice would you give them to get this conversation going and start passing out buckets and, as I've been saying, bailing some of the sort of, you know, systemic issues out of their boat?
You know, it's a good question because everybody is in such different places. That's what I'm realizing. So many have embarked on this. A lot of the social, you know, organizations, nonprofits, those who are dealing with marginalized communities already have definitely started and had many conversations. And then others who are like, oh, us, but we're just a whatever company.
Yeah.
So everybody's in a different place, but wherever people are, my approach, if I enter an organization, is there's no other way but from the top down. Period. So if you're in HR, you're not the top. Go up one, two, wherever you have to go. Start with the leadership, the board, the executives, the C-suite, whatever you call it, until they have some buy-in and understanding.
So what does that conversation look like? I want to get down to tactics, boots on the ground. And I get that it's a freaking hard question because, to your point, you got to meet people where they're at. They're all over the place.
Yes.
But what are some like things to look out for someone who's like, dude, I'm going to be an anti-racist in my company. I'm going to start working on this. I'm going to start working on my internal influence to get some of these light bulbs at the top turned on, to your point. What kind of tactical things, what levers to pull on, what buttons to push on to get the sort of top-down endorsement?
Maybe that's fair enough.
About the silver bullet. I don't know if it even exists.
No. But this is good because what are the tangible things that people can do with the limited power they have or the extraordinary amount of power they have? What can they do? And this is the beginning. Conversations are the beginning. Highlighting that there is a need to maybe have our organization look more reflective. Can we look at our policies? We don't seem to be matching the community. What's happening in the process of hiring? Hiring is one piece. We focus a lot on how do we get people in, but retention.
We overweight hiring piece. Not saying it's not important, but it's not the whole game, you know?
It's not. Well, what happens when they come in the door? I mean, so many places I've gone and I'm like, I bet you they were really chuffed that they got someone who's really good, really good at what she can do. And she's racialized, so it looks good. I feel like that's definitely in my favor, if you will. But once I'm there, then I don't want that so much anymore, right? It looks good in the picture. So there's a lot of that happens too. So yeah, retention for me is the bigger piece. Once they're in the door, how are you keeping them, right? But there's also one of the biggest easy things that you can do in any decision-making places in a workplace, any, is to say, who is being impacted by this decision? Who's not at the table? Who's not here? I have to do that. Who's not here? Oh, I don't have that lens. Okay. Who's not here and how do we get it? Doesn't mean you have to hire everybody so that you have, you know, the United Nations in your workplace, because that's not reflective of the community, likely. That's not what this is about, right? It's more about cognizant. So, okay, our board is white with the exception of one person. Who's missing and how do we get that voice here? So is it a focus group? Is it reaching out to our stakeholders? There's all kinds of ways to bring the lens to the table if you don't literally have it right now.
Right. So
there are active things that you can start to converse about in your organizations about the impact on, and have we thought about this? You know, you see things like advertising and commercials, and we see so many mishaps there. Why do those mishaps happen where unintentionally people are like that played into a major stereotype? How did you miss that? Because it's a stereotype and you're part of that belief system.
Right.
Only by asking, how will this community be impacted by this message that we're putting out? Then you can add, if you don't have the answer, go get it. Doesn't mean you have to hire everybody. Doesn't mean you have to act. It just means you have to be having those conversations internally. And in so doing, you will highlight, oh, we have a lot, we have a lot of men in this organization and we're targeting a lot of women.
Right.
And then things will shift, because when you keep asking those questions and you ask who's not here and who's impacted, you recognize who's not at your table and how relevant and important that voice would be. It's about being very transparent. Here's what we don't know. Here's what we need. Get people in.
I got a question for you. So there's this new push for NASDAQ. I'm sure you heard about this. They're going to be requiring all companies listed on the NASDAQ exchange to have, diverse boards.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like you to, what do you think about that? Is it good? Is it bad? What are the positive externalities of it? What are the negative externalities of it?
you know what? It's
an unintended consequence that I'm concerned about, which maybe I'll respond with after, you know.
Yeah. Is it tokenism or there's a lot in that, and it is definitely the trend, and it is definitely the ask. And it's not good or bad. It's just necessary. It's just absolutely needed for good reason, because so it's almost like the conversation about affirmative action, right? Like people coming in just but on virtue of their racialized bodies or their marginalized bodies. But it's, you know, it's such a misnomer. It's such an assumption that in order for somebody to show up and be that token person that represents, they must have a lesser ability to do the work. There's this misnomer. It's like, actually, they may actually supersede all that you have in your organization because of their lived experience, because of their worldly views. Like, but anyhow, that whole conversation, you know, it's unfortunate. It's necessary, because the same thing that we talked about, we don't have time for people to go, oh, perhaps maybe I could do something. We don't have time for that. So, you know, as I said, if you look at who's not there and who should be there, because it impacts your business, your outcome, and your stakeholders. And if you're not doing it, if your board doesn't look reflective of the community, how else can you do it other than to be intentional? Other than to, and it doesn't have to be this sort of like.
I mean, it's a decent argument. I mean, it's not a terrible argument.
There's no other way that, but it's not happening otherwise.
Yeah,
if it was, I mean, just, I mean, this is the problem. It's not happening.
You know, I'm kind of a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed kind of fella. And I just would like it. I'd like to see that diversity just naturally be there.
How do we get there, though? How do we get there?
I know.
Because it's not. It's not. It's not. And I'm, it's not. And you know what? It works both ways as well. Like, let me be clear. When I think about who I want to surround myself with now in terms of colleagues and work connections.
You can't say me. Who?
No, it's not you. It's people that look more like me, literally, right? That is like, I have left organizations.
Thing that we all have, of course. Yeah.
And, but it's working to my advantage as well for safety and for resources and for that lens that I need. Because I've been infiltrated with the dominant view. I very much understand what is working well for everybody else. But what I don't always know is the depth of what I don't know in the other arena. I don't know what it is to walk around. You know, one thing we don't talk about enough in terms of oppressed peoples is our disabled communities, people that have disabilities, visible or invisible. And it's so funny because it's like, is the only one that we could all be inflicted with like that. It's the only ism that you and I could both be sitting in a wheelchair tomorrow. In a heartbeat, though, literally, it's so fascinating. And until, you know, you hear people that have, you know, temporary mobility issues, you know, broken a leg, they're in a wheelchair temporarily, and they go, oh my gosh, the world is not made for me. You don't think about it unless you have to. This is, so when I say there's something happening, like I have to think about that because I am able-bodied.
Right.
I don't, you know, we haven't even talked about the LGBT community. That's a whole, like, navigating the world in those bodies. And then you add the intersectionality of race and other things.
Totally, yeah.
I can't even begin. I can't handle thinking about that every day when I'm trying to be me every day in a world that's not made for me. So what do I do? Just go, oh, not me. I don't know that. No. I go, oh, I don't know that. So how do I get that input? How do I get that input to do my work effectively? That's all everybody has to do. You don't have to have it all. But you do have to reflect on if your board, if your leadership suites are not looking, or if all of your people of color are at the bottom of your organization, it's very likely that that's a systemic problem, right? It doesn't happen just like that. It's just not a thing that just, oops, that's just how it is. All those people that are really highly skilled and smart and intelligent happen to be in white bodies. I don't buy it. I don't buy it at all.
Yeah. So where can people learn some more about you, Romina? Where can they find you? Where can they get in touch with you? This has been a really, really fun.
Yeah, I agree. So I have a website, RominaMorris.com. So that's where you can kind of find, like, I do guest speaking, I do training. I love doing leadership coaching, and of course I'll offer therapy and group therapy sessions for people. And actually that's something I'm actually starting to pitch a lot more, is organizations needing to reflect on having an anti-racist therapist on board, if you will, someone that can actually lend that lens to support those who continue to be harmed in organizations while the top is trying to figure things out. So RaminaMorris.com is my website. I'm on LinkedIn, and that's probably the only place I'm really active. I'm just starting to get into Facebook. I know, I'm such an old school. I know people are like, how can you do business without Instagram, without this and that? But you know what? This is what's comfortable for me. So yeah, and I'm happy to book a call with people and just kind of figure out where they're at on an individual level or in an organizational level. Cause again, it's both, and everybody's got work to do. What's yours, right? That's kind of my take. And that's the beauty of having this kind of a portfolio career, is that I can deliver on a number of things, all to do with equity, inclusion, and specifically anti-racism.
And you know, what's the nice thing about having a really messy garage that you have a lot of work to do in is that you can just start anywhere, and you can just, anything you do is an improvement. You know what I'm saying?
I love that analogy, because that is exactly how I feel. Doing nothing is not an option, but even if you're just thinking about doing something, it's moving. It's a step.
Yeah.
Something. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This was really a great conversation.
Thank you.
And join us next time. And follow Rumina on LinkedIn. And if you're still on Facebook, check her out over there too. Bye, everybody.